You're listening to a Black Mask podcast from blackmask.ca.
Welcome back to Black Mask, the frequency of resistance. John Clark came to Canada in 1976 from London, England, where he'd been active in trade union struggles. He worked until 1982 at the Westinghouse plant in London, Ontario, active in the Electrical Workers Union. After being laid off, John helped to form the London Union of Unemployed Workers in 1983. In 1990, he moved to Toronto to take the job of organizer with the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty. He came to Winnipeg this past week to participate in events around the MayWorks Festival of Labor and the Arts. He spoke with Black Mask on Friday about the legacy of 1919, anti-poverty organizing, and about the ongoing economic crisis. Thanks for talking with us, John, and welcome to Winnipeg. You're speaking at a MayWorks panel tonight entitled Rekindling the Spirit of 1919, the Year of the Winnipeg General Strike. And I'd like to ask, what lessons can be learned from the strike that happened 90 years ago?
Well, I mean, I think the Winnipeg General Strike has obviously gone down in history as a landmark working class struggle in this city and indeed in this country. And it took place at a time when, you know, the whole country was exploding with working class resistance in the wake of the First World War. And indeed, internationally, there was a huge upsurge that went on for several years. So the Winnipeg General Strike was one of the preeminent contributions of the Canadian workers to that wave of resistance throughout the world. So, I mean, I think that the first thing to draw from it is the uncompromising nature of the struggle, that people having deep-seated grievances, having just gone through a great war and experiencing massive injustice as workers, rose up and defiantly for weeks brought production in this city to a standstill, actually put themselves in a situation where what moved and where and how was in the hands of workers. It was an incredible event in that regard, and there's much to learn from that. But I also think that it would be a mistake to just turn it into some sanitized icon where we take a completely uncritical view of something safe, far away, and romantic. I think there were also shortcomings. I'd have to say that the Labour leaders in 1919 stood far in advance of most of those leading trade unions today. But still, at that time, I think there were shortcomings in terms of a recognition of what the stakes were. If you're going to defy capitalism, you're going to face very definite consequences, and you've got to be ready for those consequences. And, you know, once the strike got underway, there was a determination to not just smash it, but to make an example of it. They were ready to use any form of legalized violence and even illegal violence. They were ready to use provocation. They were ready to use the courts, the citizens' committee that was formed, and the federal government were virulent and determined, and they went after it and subsequently tried to make legally an example of those who they deemed leaders of the event. It was brutal. Now, it certainly wasn't just an unqualified defeat. It changed the consciousness of working people in Winnipeg and had an influence in this city and beyond for decades afterwards. But nonetheless, the fact that they took on the strike and brought it to a standstill in a very confrontational and bloody way, I think it expresses the fact that if you're going to fight, you better be able to fight to win. And you better understand that if you're going to defy capitalism, the capitalists are not going to like it, and their state is not going to like it, and you've got to be ready for that.
One of the things that happened was, at the time, was Hugh John MacDonald, the nephew of John A. MacDonald, was the premier of Manitoba, and he led, after the strike, kind of a really brutal program of deporting or arresting vast amounts of Eastern European recent immigrants and sending them to internment camps, essentially in northwestern Ontario, and then deporting them back to their home countries as one of the ways to kind of break the back of the whole strike. Is this the kind of thing you have in mind?
Well, I think it certainly was one of the elements. There was an attack on workers generally, but the xenophobic edge to it was undeniable and a very clear component of it. And I organise in the city of Toronto, where right now they're carrying out raids against undocumented workers. So things haven't changed a great deal in that regard. It's just that today we're actually not dealing primarily with Eastern European people. We're dealing with people of colour from what is contemptuously referred to as the Third World. So the racist edge to anti-working class politics has become even more overt and ugly than it was in 1919.
broad segments of the left in Winnipeg, and even I think mainstream culture, really view two events, historical events, as being of really prime importance. One was the 1919 general strike, and the other is the Red River Rebellion of 1871. One was challenging the authority of the Canadian state, the other challenging the authority of Canadian capital. We have behind the provincial legislature a giant statue of Louis Riel, a man who was hung for treason by the Canadian state. Although those events are revered, especially on the left, like I say, but kind of more broadly too, is there a discrepancy between putting things into a safe historical box? I had the chance to interview someone a few months ago from Greece who participated in the uprisings that happened there last December, and he talked about the massive uprisings against the dictatorship in 1972 in Greece that ended up overthrowing it, that many of the people who were struggling this past winter, their parents were involved in it. And yet that's a much more recent historical event than 90 years ago. But already in Greece, he said that the older folks didn't feel like uprisings that happened today were justified. They were more something, they were okay with the historical ones, but not so much right. Contemporary. I wonder if what your thoughts are on if that's the same idea where things are safer and historical and we're not able to view things the same way in contemporary reality.
Well, I think that's true of some. I think there's a sort of a tendency to prefer your struggles long ago and far away. And they can't be far away in Winnipeg, but at least they can make them a long time ago. And I mean, I think that this meeting, of course, is going to take place tonight. This commemoration of the 90th anniversary of the strike is going to take place in the context of an absolutely unprecedented crisis of capitalism. Mm-hmm. And right now, we can see some of the ways in which they're scrambling to repair the damage. And I think the lesson, as you watch what's happening, for example, in the auto industry, is that there's never a crisis of capitalism that's so severe that they can't solve it at our expense if we allow them to. And they are looking to smash trade unions or perhaps even worse, to transform them into tools for disciplining workers and imposing mm-hmm. austerity on them. Mm-hmm. Perhaps it would be better to kill them than leave them alive on that basis. Mm-hmm. And so as this unfolds, the relevance of a struggle like the Winnipeg General Strike not becomes that it provides a nice piece of nostalgia, but that it actually provides very, very vital lessons in terms of how we need to be thinking and how we need to be organizing. And if the grievances of workers in 1919 justified a general strike, then I think the grievances that are being imposed on people today justify an absolutely correspondingly uncompromising form of resistance.
You just mentioned the economic crisis that's happening. Of course, it's affecting a lot of poor and working people, giving the state an excuse to make a tax on them. But a lot of people have also viewed it as a great opportunity in terms of the crisis in capitalism and trying to exploit that. At the same time, the crisis is kind of at least presented as this really abstract global phenomenon passing through a lot of institutions, and it's not always clear for an individual or even a group or organization how to exploit those kind of weaknesses that are appearing.
That's a very complex question in many ways, and one of the factors involved is of course, is that I mean, I've been around doing this kind of work for a long time, and I've always thought in terms of an inevitable crisis that must emerge. The contradictions within the system are clear, that they can postpone things like this for extended periods of time, but they can't avoid those contradictions. So I knew that this kind of crisis was going to unfold, but I always sort of had rather hoped we'd have a bit more organized on the ground when it happened. The fact is, we are starting from quite a low level. There is a crisis of opposition. Trade unions are considerably weakened. There is not a powerful generalized social movement ready to respond to this crisis. But that's the state of affairs that we deal with. So I think we have to organize on the ground, and we have to recognize that a period like this can change things very, very quickly in terms of people's consciousness and people's capacity to resist. There are, I think, important examples starting to emerge. We've seen a landmark occupation of a factory in Chicago that people looked to as a. It wasn't just the event that happened, but it was the way workers everywhere looked to it as an inspiring example. We recently held a public meeting in Toronto where we brought up a speaker from an anti-poverty organization in Miami, Florida, where people are starting to move families into the homes that the banks are foreclosing and taking, and not do it as some sort of symbolic, high-profile gesture, but do it on a large scale, systematically. We're not in a position as an anti-poverty organization to talk in terms of organizing general strikes. Employed workers have to do that. Mm-hmm. But we have to think in terms of ways in which we can start to organize at the community level that is similarly defiant and disruptive. Mm-hmm. In Toronto, there's been an enormous condo boom that is now coming to an end. And while condos sometimes are places of privilege for very rich people, they're also at the lower level starter homes for people that don't have the capacity to buy anything else. A lot of those people are going to start losing those homes, and speculators who've bought up batches of condominiums are going to start losing them too. There's going to be a lot of empty units, and we've got to start thinking in terms of reclaiming those for people. And in the 1930s, when people organized in the face of the Great Depression, there was a defiant resistance to the eviction of families from their housing. In Toronto, they could organize, and I'm sure the situation in Winnipeg was not particularly different. Mm-hmm. They could organize large-scale mobilizations to block evictions. Mm-hmm. We've got to think in terms of that kind of rapid deployment mobilizing, not just because we want to stop families being put out of their homes, but because we want to raise the demand of a moratorium on evictions, and because we want to create a situation where it isn't a matter of sending some old codger around with a piece of authorization to change the locks, but it's a question of actually having to mobilize a large-scale police action to evict people. And that changes mm-hmm. things, changes things dramatically. And it's a way in which people can start fighting for their right to survive. And I think the generalized notion that's starting to come into people's heads is there's a crisis, but who's going to pay for it? The auto companies are determined that auto workers will pay for it, and governments are determined that the system of providing for people who are unemployed will remain abysmal, and nothing will be provided to meet the needs, and people will lose their hope, their housing, people will lose their jobs, people will lose their future. And we have to be prepared to actually show that it's possible through resistance to challenge that state of affairs. I think as well, we have to learn one of the other important lessons of 1919 is that it was led by people who actually had a perspective not just of fighting for some concessions, but recognized the source of the ills was the actual capitalist system itself, and wanted to name and challenge that system and fight for something better. I don't think we're going to be able to build anything that's inspiring and successful if we don't have the same perspective today.
A lot of the things you're talking about needing to happen are things that I think the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty has been doing really well over the last, I guess, 15 or more years of its existence. OCAP combines work around direct action tactics, casework, and larger campaign work. There's very few organizations I know of here in Winnipeg that combine all those three things. Most organizations are doing two, if not maybe only one. And I'm wondering what you think the strengths of combining those things are, those different ways of organizing are, as well as if there are any weaknesses, if it's hard to sustain going in all those seemingly different directions.
Well, I think it's the way to go, although I'd have to step back and say our immediate weakness is that we're doing it at the moment on a pathetically small scale compared to what needs to be done. I mean, even in the context of one city, of Toronto, OCAP is simply not going to be able to do the kind of work that needs to be done in the face of this crisis by itself. It's going to take a much broader community-based initiative to defend people. But I do think that combining those kind of elements is important if you're going to build a movement. I mean, we realized long ago that you know, if somebody walks into your office and says that their electricity is being cut off, or they're facing deportation, or they have no income, or they're being evicted, and the only thing you can offer them is some esoteric march a few weeks ago on some generalized issue, it's not going to exactly do much for them. You have to be able to show that you can defend people, that you have a means of fighting back that counts for something. But on the other hand, if the only thing you can offer people is just this unending grey existence of fighting to survive without actually showing that you can fight for something better, that you have ideas that count for something, then similarly you're going nowhere. I think you have to combine a sort of a vision of what you hope to achieve and what how you want to alter society with the most practical day-to-day kind of struggle.
So how does OCAP's direct action casework work?
The truth is that these days we've established enough of a reputation with those people who we challenge that we don't actually have to take the actions as frequently as we used to. You know, they know that we will come to their office. We know that we will do these things. But as a model where we, assuming a case goes through to a situation of collective action, what generally happens is somebody will come to us and say, my employer didn't pay me, or the welfare office has told me I can't have welfare because of some pathetic, evasive misreading of the rules, even their own rules, or whatever. And we respond by sending the oppressing entity an ultimatum. We name the grievance. We say you have X amount of time to provide the following remedy. And then if it isn't provided, we'll organise a suitable collective action. That might be a mass delegation to a welfare office. It might be that an employer owns a restaurant and we go and organise an occupation of the dining room or whatever it is to press the demand. And generally, in those kinds of situations, we have some sort of notions of ways in which we can escalate the level of mobilisation and the challenge so that, for example, on one particular occasion, a delegation to a welfare office didn't succeed, so we found out where the manager of the office lived and we organised an action at his house. And so those kinds of things, that's basically the format that we follow. We might do direct actions as a form of political demonstration that's linked to an overall campaign. I mean, one of the ones that people will always remember is the time we went when James Flaherty was not the federal finance minister but the provincial Ontario finance minister. We went to his office and evicted him. We put his furniture out on the street. So that was part of an overall campaign, however, that we were launching against the Tories, in which we were trying to build a broader alliance of workers and community-based organisations. So it wasn't just that we randomly descended on Flaherty's office and hurled his filing cabinets out the door. We did it as part of a plan to build the campaign.
CAW had been giving quite a bit of funding to OCAP before that, and if I remember correctly, after the Flaherty action, they got really disturbed and pulled out a lot of the funding.
I think we have to build, you know, principled working alliances with even very conservative-led organisations on some bases. I mean, I must say, for example, it's true the CAW did defund us, and there was quite a bitter disagreement over the James Flaherty action. But on the other hand, when a couple of us were in jail, I must say to the credit of Buzz Hargrove that he did participate in an event calling for our release and condemned it. So there were still limited forms of cooperation that I think were fair. And if he'd been sent to jail, I think OCAP would have mobilised not out of a personal fondness for Buzz Hargrove, but to condemn the jailing of an elected workers' leader of a trade union. Mm-hmm. Having said that, I do think that we do have to recognise that there is existing within trade unions a bureaucracy. Mm-hmm. That it has arisen on the basis of a compromise in society that actually came to an end perhaps 30 years ago. And during the entire Liberal period, this very conservative bureaucracy, increasingly conservative bureaucracy, has been limiting social challenge and mobilisation to forms that are simply not adequate to the crisis that we've been facing. And if that was true during the long period of neoliberal attack, at this sharp crisis point, it becomes infinitely more true. I mean, if you look at developments in the auto industry, for example, at the moment, you're watching the spectacle of the union leaderships broker one round of concessions after another, and after one load of concessions goes through, they're ready for the next. Mm-hmm. They're ready for the next round. Now, I think that means not just that they're not sufficiently militant, but they are actually tied to this system in a way that becomes a fundamental problem. Mm-hmm. Because if you're going to say no to concessions, you know, the bankruptcy of the auto companies is not a fiction. It actually exists. And if auto unions were to refuse to accept concessions, there would be a very sharp attack. They would talk in terms of closing up and all the rest of it. But on the other hand, the formula of watching mass layoffs and the destruction of all the gains that have taken place is just simply intolerable. But if you are going to challenge that, you have to be able to compose questions that bring us back to the Winnipeg General Strike, mm-hmm. which is who owns and controls in this society, what is going to be produced and on what basis? And those are questions that the present leadership of the CAW would certainly not be prepared to talk about, much less put into effect.
OCAP works with people who I think are hit the hardest by capitalism, folks who are being refused their welfare, at risk of being deported, sex trade workers who are being gentrified out of their own neighborhoods. Work that's really important and really key. There are other segments of the working class that aren't included in that group. And in terms of forging broader movements, do you see it as one struggle among many, or do you see it as some kind of key point that needs to be targeted, or is it kind of an ethical thing of these are the people who are hit hardest and so that they're the ones who need to be defended?
Well, no, I think it's an important particular area of working class organizing, and one that perhaps hasn't been paid enough attention to. I mean, you are not going to be able to maintain the very fighting capacity of the working class if increasingly large numbers of people are impoverished and atomized and demoralized, and so building resistance amongst the poor and amongst the unemployed is a very important element of working class organizing, and it happens to be the area of work that we're formed to take on. But I don't think that by any manner of means it is some particular area that is important above all else. Mm-hmm. I think that needs to be, it needs in fact to be linked to the struggles of employed workers and including workers who are currently earning a living wage and want to defend their living wage. As a matter of fact, I think to some extent what we are is a product of an unhealthy movement, in the sense that if you had a vibrant, dynamic, militant labor movement that had an anti-capitalist perspective, we would be a kind of a significant auxiliary within that movement. But unfortunately, that's not the case. Mm-hmm. And so people sometimes, you know, talk about OCAP as an inspiration and you know, absolutely an example of this and an example of that. In some ways, that's flattering, but it's also a little depressing if you think that a small Toronto downtown-based organization has that much of a reputation. It's a sign of how general the malaise is within the movement. And so, what we do is important, but it's only part of a very much bigger job that needs to be done.
What OCAP does with direct action advocacy and casework is very different from what a social service agency does. One of the big problems with social service agencies, among many problems, is that a lot of times advocates are advocating on behalf of people that are coming from totally different situations with them. And obviously, OCAP is a poor people's organization and a working class organization. And yet, the people who are advocates may or may not have been threatened with deportation themselves, have been kicked off welfare themselves. I wonder if these issues come up in the organization and how those issues are addressed.
I mean, I think there's a very high level in OCAP's active membership of people who have personally experienced these situations, who know what it is to be told they're not going to get any welfare and such like. I do think it's fair to say that if you look at what OCAP is, though, in terms of you talking to the question of OCAP's membership, there is something of a distinction between people who are political activists and people who have come into the organization much more out of being personally poor, and not to say that there's any sort of firm dividing line between those categories, but as a generalization, there are people who are motivated to participate in something like OCAP out of initial political conviction, and there are those whose own experiences of oppression, of poverty, leads them in. And in that regard, I think it's fair to say that there is within OCAP something of a distinction between an active membership of people who would come regularly to our meetings and a broader periphery of people who see OCAP as their organisation but might not be active in exactly the same way and might be active on a more informal basis, and that's certainly true. For example, we have a very, very significant base within the west end of Toronto, the area of Etobicoke, in the Somali community, where there's enormous numbers of mainly Somali women who have played a very, very important role in many of the struggles that we've taken up. But generally speaking, they're not people who come out to our membership meetings, and their participation is not quite as precise and easy to define. But they're absolutely central to the life of the organisation. But perhaps that's a reflection of the fact that in anti-poverty organising, you can't always think in terms of rigid structures and forms and processes. You have to think much more creatively, and sometimes things are much harder to pin down than an organiser might wish for. And that's the situation. And if that's true of people in the Somali community, it's infinitely more true of the base we have in the homeless population, etc.
Earlier you mentioned condoization and the two roles it can play. As I understand, there's been a lot of luxury condo developments in Toronto over the past maybe 20 years. A lot of struggles against gentrification has happened, and that's something Winnipeg has seen much, much more recently, and I think is maybe not quite on the horizon, but before, about 5 years ago, there was very little in the way of condos in the city at all, and we're starting to see that increase quite a bit. So I'm wondering what the experiences with OCAP have been in their struggles against gentrification or other struggles in Toronto that we could maybe learn from as this problem starts to increase here.
I think you start to confront an agenda of gentrification, and you start to see how all the powers line up behind it. That means the cops are going to be used to clear people out of neighbourhoods. It means that those who fund social service agencies will start to use their control to ensure what is funded and how, and so that in Toronto, you know, funding for service provision for homeless people on the streets is being withdrawn in favour of ways of hiding people away. So you'll start to see the virulence of the agenda. And you'll start to see all the forms of support at the political level, at the administrative level, and all the rest of it. And the only real response you have is the cohesion and solidarity of the communities under attack. So that the strategy with the homeless is to push them away, intimidate them, and make them invisible. And our strategy is to organize collective actions that do the exact opposite, that bring people together, that make them visible, that make it clear to them that they're not going to be atomized and driven away. In the case of one of the important ways they're trying to clear low-income neighbourhoods in Toronto is to allow public housing to deteriorate, so that the Toronto Housing Corporation houses about 180,000 people, and it's the largest landlord in Canada. Their housing stock is being allowed to run down so that it can be demolished and replaced with condo communities in which there's supposedly a rent geared to income component. Mm-hmm. So the destruction of public housing is very important. So we're working really vigorously to organize with tenants to actually fight for repairs so that the structures are defended, they are preserved, and it becomes less and less possible for them to just pull them down and hand them over to the developers. So at every point, I think it becomes a question of relying on the solidarity and building the solidarity of communities under attack. Although I must say the crisis now rather changes everything, mm-hmm. in the sense that we can no longer assume that there's going to be this triumphant agenda of redevelopment. It looks as if it may well grind to a halt, and we may be dealing with a different type of struggle in a different period.
You mentioned OCAP as what should be a very small component of a way broader movement of working class people. But there does seem to have been some rise in the profile of anti-poverty work across colonial Canada. There's now a Halifax Coalition Against Poverty, HCAP. There's anti-poverty groups in British Columbia. I wonder if there's networking that happens between the groups across Canada, if there's options for solidarity there, and any hope you see in that kind of emerging movement.
Well, we do. I mean, we certainly do have networks, and we certainly do maintain contacts, and we certainly do, to some degree, strategize and even visit each other and that kind of thing. But there isn't, I think, yet the level of coordination that there should be. I mean, we ultimately, again, this crisis now, I think, poses possibilities in terms of organizing on a scale that just is completely different. I mean, we've been able to establish some pockets of anti-poverty organizing and resistance in different places, but I think we are no longer in a situation where we're looking at, you know, stalwart activists doing what they can in communities where there's general sympathy but limited participation. I think we're talking about communities banding together to survive and changing the whole nature of this initiative from being just pockets of organizing to a real movement. I think that becomes a real possibility. Now, I mean, I don't know I don't know exactly how this crisis will unfold, obviously, and I don't know the speed with which people's thinking is going to change and people's receptiveness to the notion of resistance and organizing is going to happen. A lot of people have said, with some justification, that during the Great Depression there was a period of several years where people really didn't know what to do and there wasn't that much initial organizing. Mm-hmm. I don't think we can assume that that's the case, but it's a possibility. But I do think we're certainly entering a period of time when it isn't going to be nearly as hard to convince people they need to act. Mm-hmm. I think that's pretty well a given, that we're going to see a situation of capacities to mobilize increasing, but we're also going to see a system that is pushing back much harder. So we're going to see, I think, some very, very, very major struggles. And the repression side of the lessons of 1919 also need to be looked at.
A lot of people's impressions when they come to Winnipeg are that it appears to be a strong, very working class city. And yet a lot of the people who live here, the vast majority, will not want to be, not identify as working class at all. And meanwhile, their mother will be a nurse and their father will be a postal worker, and they'll say, no, I can't be working class, I went to university. Yeah. I wonder what importance you see in that self-identification.
I'm sure that those illusions were not unknown in 1919. Mm-hmm. But I think it is, it's true, it's fair comment, it is stronger today. And there has been a whole period of indoctrinating people. I mean, I even remember when occasionally I used to go up to the CAW's educational facility at Port Elgin and on Lake Huron. And there, one of the first questions they used to ask people is, what class do you belong to? And almost invariably, auto workers and auto parts workers, etc., would say that they were middle class. And that has been really drilled into people. In a way, actually, when I came here originally from England, and I found that a little shocking. There's sort of much more. There was much more sort of sense of being working class, I think, where I came from. But on the other hand, like everything in society, those contradictions tend to be. There's a contradiction in those contradictions, because If you've told people for years that they're part of the good life, that they're really the middle class, they own their own home, they're not like these people who rent, or they're not like these people who are on welfare or whatever, and you've created in them these often quite reactionary illusions, when the reality of the situation changes, those illusions can be transformed into their opposite. They can become a source of indignation and a source of anger and even a source of rage. When the dream is shown to be false, then I think that the people look for nuances, and they can find those, and they won't find those in being wannabe yuppies. They'll find it only in serious forms of working class resistance. I think what we're starting to see and what we're starting to grapple with is the ways in which this crisis is likely to play out in the context of anti-poverty organizing in Toronto, in the context of poor communities in Toronto. And there are some indications. I mean, the unemployment insurance system in this country, renamed laughably employment insurance, has become a joke. It simply doesn't insure the unemployed against unemployment. And so you're going to get a whole category, and you are already getting a whole category of people who've lost their jobs but don't have any form of income, and at this point have a few savings, so they don't qualify for welfare. So they're sort of like waiting to be poor enough to apply for social assistance. And that's going to be a very explosive segment of the population on welfare in Toronto under the pseudo-progressive mayoral leadership of David Miller. You have a situation where the contingency fund to deal with increased welfare caseload has been taken down from $90 million to a mere $8 million. So there's going to be a situation where welfare offices start turning people away. Mm-hmm. There's going to be evictions. There's going to be... so. And I think what is going to have to emerge is a community-based mobilization against that, that's going to have a daily life. It's going to have to be hard-hitting, and it's going to have to be very, very serious. But it can no longer be organized on the basis of a downtown office anti-poverty organization. It's going to have to assume a life of its own that's out there in communities. There's going to have to be people sitting around kitchen tables organizing to fight evictions. There's going to have to be a different approach that is much more diffused and much more based in the actual communities under attack. And OCAP would like to be one of the catalysts that leads to that mobilization. I think it's also a very, very significant element of the thing in a city with as many immigrant populations as Toronto is going to be an incredible increase in racism. Including a targeting of the thousands and thousands of people who live here without status. Now, just as the Eastern European immigrants were targeted during the time of the Winnipeg General Strike, there's going to be a targeting of those populations. And it isn't that they, in fact, don't want non-status people here. They do want them here. But they want them to be scared and vulnerable, and they want them to be intimidated to the point where they'll work for any wages under any conditions. Mm-hmm. And the attacks on that population, we've seen, as I said, raids being carried out on workplaces for the first time and those kinds of things. That's going to be a really important area of mobilizing. And the organization No One is Illegal in Toronto has really given a lead there. So I think what we're going to have to adapt to relatively soon, is just a change in the scale of things and a change in the need for the levels of organizing. And that's what I think is going to be decisive. It isn't that there's some, you know, march that's going to be particularly clever or something like that. It's going to be a real job to organize people on a scale we've just never done before.
Thanks a lot for talking with us, John.